respondent, Petitioner Leon Reyes. We're here today to determine whether or not a mother, specifically Cheryl Rothering, is going to be responsible for Aaron Rothering's acts of shooting a gun at a group of pedestrians on a sidewalk as he drove his vehicle by this group of pedestrians. And I have to admit that when I was preparing for this particular argument, I found it quite ironic that the cases that I felt supported our position the best were the very same cases cited by the Court of Appeals in overturning the trial court's decision, where the trial court, in fact, did find the mother responsible under Section 343.15 sub 2 sub B. I say that the two cases that support my position, McCallion v. Wojak and Employers Mutual v. Hawk, are the strongest cases in support of my position for one simple reason. The parents in McCallion who tried to avoid liability under Section 343.15 sub 2 argued that the statute was vague, ambiguous, and the same Court of Appeals that authored the decision in this case said specifically the terms willful misconduct and the damages are not vague. They have common, unambiguous meanings. In other words, they rejected the parents' contention that there was something ambiguous about the statute. Then this court, the Supreme Court, in Employers Mutual v. Hawk, addressed the very same issue, i.e. the ambiguity of Section 343.15 sub 2 sub B, and stated, in our opinion, the language of the statute is so definite and certain that it does not require the application of any rules of construction. The court continued, it is our opinion that the language of the statute is too clear to admit of any conclusion other than it means what it says. So I guess the question that we are now here to answer is, well, what does it say? It specifically says, as I read it, as applied to this case, taking the language of the statute and applying it to this case, it says, as I see it, any willful misconduct of Aaron when operating his motor vehicle will be imputed to Cheryl. Cheryl is responsible for any damages caused by the willful misconduct of Aaron when operating his motor vehicle. I think it's important to note that the statute does not say anything about any damage caused by the operation of the motor vehicle. The issue we have to address is the contention of the Court of Appeals in its decision reversing the trial court that 343.15 sub 2 sub B only applies to the actual physical operation of a motor vehicle and the mental discretion exercised in the operation of the motor vehicle and nothing more. It doesn't talk about liability in the nebulous concept of arising out of. But if you take a look at this case, there is absolutely no question. If you ask the question, was Leon Reyes damaged by Aaron Rothering when he was operating his motor vehicle, that is an unequivocal yes. There's no question about that. He was injured as as Aaron Rothering and Marlon Jameson drove by, leveled shotguns, Aaron out his window.
Counselor, what if he'd stopped and they got out of the car and shot?
Then I think, in order to be consistent, Justice, that I would have to say that that does not, the statute section does not apply.
Does that make sense to you, that there would be that kind of distinction, that mom is liable if they drive the car and slow down and shoot out the window, but mom's not responsible if they drive the car to the point where they're going to shoot, but get out of the car and stand a foot away?
As far as making sense, I'm not sure. I think that's the only way we can apply 343.15 sub 2 sub B because of the language used.
But suppose they stop the car and shoot out of the window anyway.
And they're not operating the vehicle at that particular point in time?
Well, I tell you, under the drunk driving cases, even if the car is stopped, it's operating a vehicle.
Well, then that particular issue could be addressed by addressing the question of, well, is he operating the motor vehicle at that time? In our case, it's clear that they were operating the motor vehicle. There's no question about that. That's clear that he was operating the motor vehicle. It was a willful act. that caused damage to Leon Reyes. And, I'm sorry.
I was going to give you another example. Suppose you have several people in a car. Several of them are under 18, and suppose there's a rape in the car, in a moving car. And they're all, in effect, parties to this crime. And so there's willful misconduct.
Not
guys driving while operating a motor vehicle. Do you think that's going to be covered by this statute?
No, because in this particular case, you have to remember, we're not asking, for instance, Cheryl Rothering to be liable for Marlon Jamieson's actions. We're only asking her to be liable for Aaron Rothering's actions, the person who is actually operating the car. So if Aaron Rothering is operating the motor vehicle, I don't believe he would be capable of committing those particular acts. And I don't believe that if somebody was in the back seat raping a girl that you could impute the liability of Aaron Rothering to her mother. I just don't see how you could do that because his...
There's a conspiracy going. And that would make him more liable. And you could do any battery where they've picked the victim, they've agreed that he's going to be beaten up. They get him into the car.
Well, in that particular...
Turn up the radio so no one can hear the screams.
The way I look at it is the arguments you're making are valid and legitimate points that you are making, that when you take a look at this statute that you can come up, as did Heritage, with a whole bunch of scenarios that don't make sense. But the problem is the statute doesn't carve that exception out. And if I'm going to be consistent in my arguments, then I'm going to have to say, if you've got liability of Aaron Rothering while he's operating the car, that it can be said, okay, his liability, he is liable for something at the time he's operating the car, then and in that event, yes, under this statute, he must be responsible. Because I believe I have to be consistent in my arguments here. Because the problem is that the legislature hasn't carved out these scenarios. Nobody sat down when they drafted the statute and said, yeah, but what about the rape situation where there's a conspiracy to commit a crime while he's operating the motor vehicle? Theoretically, mom can be held responsible for it. Did our legislature intend mom to be responsible for that?
Well, isn't that the ultimate question, counsel?
Yes.
I mean, because just the fact that we can draw out examples that if the statute is read literally, as you are asking us to, it also would cover some of the, you know, the examples that we're talking about here. So our number one goal is to discern what the intent of the legislature is. And one of our rules of construction is that the legislature does not intend an absurd result. And we can draw out absurdities if we are to read this statute literally. And as a result, your argument, I think, is a bit weak.
Well, here's the question. Is holding mom responsible? Let's say Aaron's driving the car, and there is a conspiracy to commit a crime, and somebody is raped in the back seat. The question is it absurd to hold mom liable and responsible under that scenario? And the question I have, is it any more absurd or less absurd to hold mom or dad responsible when little Joey gets behind the wheel of the car and decides that he's going to go deliberately run somebody over with his car? Because even the Court of Appeals concedes in its decision that under that situation the statute would apply. Is it absurd to hold, if my kid got into a car and decided one day to go out and I see that guy over there, I don't like him, I'm going to go run him down. Under this statute, I'm clearly liable and responsible. It's not that big a stretch or a step to go to the next scenario, and here's why. I think what the legislature was doing when they took a look at this statute was saying, you know what? Driving a motor vehicle and driving privileges are an incredible responsibility. A lot of damage can be done when a kid gets behind the wheel of a car, not just auto accidents. That car is an instrument to a lot of things that can go wrong, a lot of damage. And if you've got a kid that is out of control and you let him have driving privileges, you can assume that as a parent, he's going to get into a lot of trouble behind the wheel of that car. And if you don't like it, and you don't want to be responsible, then you can exercise your privileges under 343.15 sub 3 and revoke his driving privileges. So I think the legislature, when they took a look at this, said, look, globally, cars, kids can get into a lot of trouble with cars, and it's not just accidents, because they specifically used the phrase, I'm imputing not only negligence, but willful conduct of your children behind the wheel of a car, and I'm giving it to you, Mom and Dad, if you sign that application. Therefore, you know what? You better be darn sure before you let your kid get behind the wheel of a car, you trust him. Because we realize kids get into a lot of trouble with cars. And I think that's the intent behind the statute. And as far as the absurdity of liability, again, I don't think it's that far of a stretch to say if I'm going to hold you responsible for deliberately running somebody over, that we take it the next step. And if injury is caused when you're behind the wheel of that car, Mom and Dad, we're going to come looking to you. And if you don't trust your kid, then revoke your sponsorship.
Who can you trust?
What?
Does it make any difference whether or not the willful misconduct and the automobile are integrally related? Here you have a drive-by shooting. Arguably, there cannot be a drive-by shooting unless you're operating a vehicle. What if you're operating a vehicle? You call on the phone to someone, you're making harassing phone calls, person suffers emotional distress, a lawsuit is brought as a result of these continuing harassing phone calls that just almost coincidentally happen to be made in a car phone. They could be made someplace else. It seems to me in that fact situation that maybe the argument can be made that the phone calls and operating a motor vehicle is not related in the same way to the vehicle as a drive-by shooting is. What about that distinction?
Again, and I'm not trying to beg the question here, I honestly did wrestle with scenarios like that in the sense that, well, Kinnear, your argument is that if the damage arises out when he's operating the car and he causes damage, the key inquiry is, was damage caused when he's operating the car? Well, yeah, theoretically it was. Does that make any sense? Probably not.
Well, see, I shifted it a bit. I'm saying that the operation of the car is integrally related to the willful misconduct.
Yes.
And the phone call, it wouldn't be.
Yeah, I understand.
Drive-by shooting, it would be.
Yeah. And then to finish, what I meant to say was that, honestly, looking at all of you in the eye, I really believe you've got to make the determination when examining on this a case-by-case basis that you have to first start with the proposition, yes, was there damage caused when he was operating the car? Yes, okay. Then I really do believe you have to ask the second question. Was the use of the motor vehicle integral to the commission of the act? I think a rational and reasonable interpretation of the statute requires that, or else we are going to end up into the absurd. And I do believe if you look at that on a case-by-case basis and say willful conduct, causing damage, and the use of this motor vehicle was clearly integral to the commission of the crime, then I say yes, 343.15 applies. And I do believe you do have to make that inquiry.
Well, the title of the chapter is Operator's Licenses. What's wrong with the argument that all Mom or Dad are doing when they sign is to allow for an operator's license, and therefore the statute refers only to those acts having to do with the operation of the car?
Well, then again, where do you draw the line then when in this particular case he was clearly operating the car and it does have to do with the operation of the car because he couldn't have committed this crime, as he admitted under cross-examination at trial, unless he had the car? It clearly arises out of, if you take a look at the issues of arising out of and arising out of the use of an automobile cases and insurance, this damage and liability clearly arises out of the...
Where do you get the term arises out of?
No, I'm not saying, but that's what you're implying. You're
that,
saying...
That term is not found in the statute anymore, is it?
I understand that, but you're saying in order that you want to construct the statute, or you want to construe the statute, that it means, even though it says any willful conduct when operating, what you want it to really mean is that any damage arising out of the operation of the motor vehicle. That's what you're saying that the statute should be interpreted as.
That's what the Court of Appeals said.
Exactly.
They added the words willful misconduct arising out of the operation of a motor vehicle.
Exactly. That's what they did. They said, we're taking a clear and unambiguous statute and saying, even though it says any damage when operating, we're saying it means damage arising out of the operation. They're reading into this statute a construction that I don't believe they can do.
And let's just talk about when operating. Now, let's just go back to the beginning for a moment. Suppose they've operated the car and they've left it in the middle of the highway, broke down, and they don't take any precautions about lighting it or anything else, or moving it to the side. So now somebody smashes into it and is hurt, and of course that's negligence on their part. So would that be covered under the statute? Negligence when operating a motor vehicle. It's now stopped.
Yeah, I understand, and I think that a liberal interpretation of the statute would require the court to determine that if are you saying that the car broke down or they just left it there? Doesn't matter. They just left the car there in a place that was dangerous. I believe a liberal interpretation of that statute imposing liability on the parents would impose liability. Because of that, I don't think in those situations you can separate out if you leave the road on a highway that can be construed operating.
So you're going to say that's operating, all right.
Yes.
And if the car, but your position is if they do an act while that car is being operated, it is covered by this statute, even though they could do that same act without a car. They could shoot from the sidewalk.
No, but again, I believe it gets tied to the issue of the integral relationship of the motor vehicle to what happened. Because leaving the car on the road, you couldn't get it there unless you operated it, and the fact that you're leaving that car there is integral to what happened. If you just happen to go shoot somebody and then get in your car and take off, you don't necessarily have to have the car to do that. It's not integral to what happened. So I think there's the distinction.
So you need double barrel. There's a two-prong test.
I'm sorry.
And it's a two-prong test.
Yes, that's why.
Operation and integral.
I do believe that's the only way you can make sense out of this particular statute is you have to look at that second prong. Otherwise, we will end up with a no just stopping point, an absurd statute, which I don't think the legislature intended. Above and beyond that, the only thing I have to add is with regard to, though the insurance coverage issues on they're before the court, I think this kind of goes both ways with the, we've already got a case within this state that indicates that shooting deer out of a moving vehicle arises out of the use and operation of a motor vehicle. The logic and rationale used with regard to that particular case can't be distinguished. Of course, there's a difference between shooting people and shooting deer, but from a functional standpoint, the rationale used with regard to, well, if shooting at a deer out of a moving car arises out of its use and operation, then shooting at Leon Reyes arises out of its use and operation.
Was that an interpretation of the statute or an insurance policy?
That's an insurance policy. That's the... But it kind of goes, in my opinion, to the whole two-prong test thing, where I really believe you do have to have the two prongs. And what I'm saying is that within our law, when we take a look at what is use of a motor vehicle, we have already said that shooting at a deer is use of a motor vehicle. It was integral to what they were doing at the time. Thus, in our particular case, it was integral to the commission of this act by Aaron Rothering. Here, in closing, I really don't have anything more to say other than it's a difficult, difficult issue. I believe the statute does say what it says, but I do believe we do have to have the two-prong analysis. And to the extent that what this court determines and imposes liability upon the mom, if nothing else, it's sending a message to people out there. Times have changed. This statute was created, I believe, in 1971. I don't think the quote-unquote drive-by shootings were prevalent at that time, but I do believe it sends a message to the parents that if you're going to sign this statute or you sign your application of your child to drive, you better take it really seriously. And if you got a problem, kid, then you better revoke it. And if the legislature, when reading the decision that would fine Cheryl Rothering, if this court so determines, doesn't like it, then they can come back and make the law more specific. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Could I ask you a question?
What about, there's a subsection 4 to this statute, 343.15, and that deals with situations where you don't have to have a parent as a sponsor. A person who does not have a living parent, for example. What impact does this subsection 4 have on how we should interpret the statute?
The way I look at subsection 4 is that you take a look at 2 when it says, Mom and Dad, you sign this application, you're going to be responsible. Subsection 3 says, if you've got an uncontrollable kid, you can get out of it by sending the appropriate notice. And now his driving privileges are suspended. But then it says, yeah, but look at number 4, where we've got a situation where maybe mom has suspended it. Now, child, we're giving you the opportunity, because again, the legislature recognized that driving a motor vehicle can be important. We are giving you, child, the opportunity to go get your license if you can't get mom to sign, if we have appropriate circumstances met, appropriate criteria met. And under that situation, the state is saying, hey, if you can meet these criteria, we'll let you get your license, even though mom and dad aren't signing or mom and dad aren't available. That's the way I look at it. But I think that's a pretty tough burden under sub 4 for a child to obtain his license without mom and dad's signature. There are some pretty specific criteria.
One situation is where both parents are dead.
Correct.
All right. And I don't read this to say that the department must issue a license, but may issue a license.
Well, if sub 4 sub A says the department may issue, then it's up to the state. I suppose at that particular point in time, the state has to make a decision as to whether or not this individual standing before them is somebody worthy of a driver's license.
Well, I mean, does the state, do you allocate any responsibility to the state at that point?
No, for 2 reasons. Number 1, it's not statutorily imposed. And number 2, that under 893.80, that would probably be a discretionary decision anyway, for which no liability would be imposed on a state actor who would give a license to somebody. So I'm not saying that the state assumes some liability there. I'm saying they assume some responsibility to determine whether that person is a capable driver or deserving of a license. But I'm not saying that the state would then thereby assume some liability because they let little John Doe have his driver's license.
Counsel, would you address the insurance coverage issues separate from the Sponsorship Act?
As far as insurance coverage goes, I think that argument is fairly simple in the sense that Section 632.32 sub 3 sub B specifically mandates coverage. For coverage extends to any person legally responsible for the use of the motor vehicle. Cheryl Rothering is clearly liable as we see it under 343.15. Therefore, Heritage's policy per statute must extend coverage to her, regardless of this issue of whether or not they were or were not residents in the same household.
Thank you, Counsel. Before you begin, Mr. Simpson, I'd like to introduce to you all students from University of Wisconsin Stevens Point. Would they rise, please? Well, welcome. Thank you for coming, and we hope you enjoy the session. Please be seated. And as is our practice, I'll introduce the court to you all. on my far left is Justice Dave Prosser. To his right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. And to his right, Justice John Wilcox. And at the far right, Justice Patrick Crooks. With that done, you may proceed after the respite. Mr. Simpson should have a green light. Please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, Arthur Simpson appearing on behalf of Defendant Appellant Great Way Insurance Company. We're here today, number one, on the sponsorship issue, which is whether or not, with respect to a drive-by shooting, the parent is liable under the statute that we've been discussing, Section 343.15. Should the Court reverse the Court of Appeals finding with respect to that, we have preserved our rights and would also present four separate insurance coverage issues to the Court, all of which were addressed in our brief and which I hope to have time to address with you briefly this afternoon. The statute at issue provides that any negligence or willful misconduct of a person under the age of 18 years when operating a motor vehicle upon the highways is imputed to the parents. The common law did not impose such a liability upon a parent. This is a statute that is, therefore, in derogation of the common law and should be strictly construed as such. That makes us a little different from insurance company or from insurance coverage cases that Mr. Knurr cited in his brief relating to what is arising out of the use of a vehicle, where we had a liberal construction of the term arising out of the use. This statute is one that is to be strictly construed because it is in derogation of the common law.
Mr. Simpson, I've never been very persuaded by that general rule of construction. What makes common law, judge-made law, any better than statutory law?
Well, the position is that the legislature understands what the common law is when they enact the statute, and their intent is to carve out a narrow exception to that as opposed to a broad-based exception. And now, there are places where that doesn't apply. For example, the classic example is one that I ran into in the court a couple weeks ago, in a trial court a couple weeks ago, it's sometimes called the berry picker statute or the recreational use statute. That's one where the legislature went out of its way to say that the statute was in derogation of the common law, but is to be very liberally construed in favor of a finding of no liability for the property owner. I believe the statute is 895.52, but don't hold me to that. It's the recreational use statute. This is not a statute of that nature, and I believe it's one that is to be strictly construed, particularly given the tremendous exposure that it's an unlimited exposure to the parent that makes this a rather harsh statute in terms it's not even one that has a damage cap. Our public policies, municipalities, and doctors are entitled to caps on their damages, but I guess if you're a parent, you don't have the benefit of that.
Well, if you're going to strictly construe it, why are we adding the words when arising from the operation of?
I'm sorry, why are we?
If you're going to strictly construe it, why did the Court of Appeals add the words when arising from the operation of a vehicle instead of just said when operating?
I don't think they're adding words there. When I look at this statute, and I look at all the cases that have interpreted it, which we discussed in our brief, the term when operating a motor vehicle upon the highways means just that. The liability arises from something you do when you're operating the vehicle on the highways. The wrong here doesn't arise from the operation of the car. It arises from the shotgun pellets that were fired into Leon Reyes' face. That has nothing to do with operating a vehicle. I think it comes back, an important point to me is, anyway, that it comes back to the fact that we have a driver's license sponsorship statute here. You're responsible for the way your child operates a car. That does not then slide into the liability for the rape that happens in the car or the harassing phone call that happens to happen in the car because the child doesn't want to do that his home or some other location. It doesn't arise. It doesn't create liability for a drive-by shooting. One thing that I would note, just in passing, is the legislature has spoken with respect to these types of criminal actions. We have a statute that imposes liability on the parents. I believe it's 895.03, up to the limit of whatever the small claims court venue is currently. I believe it's $5,000. It was, I think, $2,500 at the time of this particular incident. Let me just check my notes here. Thank you. the, oh, he has a number here. Here we go. The, I don't have that with me, I'm sorry. The cases that discuss this, the McCallion case talks about the obligation under the statute stating the legislature selected sponsors who know the minor's characteristics and control, have some degree of control over the minor's driving. Operation of a motor vehicle is a skill involving mental discretion as well as physical dexterity. We want to control the caliber of the driving, as the McCallion case referred to. Aaron's culpability here does not stem from operating a vehicle. It arises from shooting Leon Reyes, a, for lack of a better term, non-auto-related cause. That's what the Court of Appeals found, and that's why the Court of Appeals did not invoke the sponsorship statute. I cite many examples of the potential absurdities if the court is going to adopt a rule that is so broad as to say that, well, if the car is involved in this somehow, that's good enough to invoke sponsorship liability. The court dealt with that at length during Mr. Kinnear's presentation. I think that the concerns raised implicitly are very valid. This is a statute that applies when you're operating a car, when you're driving a car, and you cause damage.
How do you distinguish the Thompson case?
The Thompson case is one of the two deer hunting cases, as I recall. My distinction on that, Judge, is that for heaven's sake, there's a difference between shooting at deer and shooting at people. Let me continue. I understand that. I want to clarify that rather than giving a vague answer I've already given. Shooting at deer from a vehicle is a practice that reasonable people, and that's what you use to construe a statute, what would a reasonable person can believe that you're meaning there. The court found in the Thompson case, at least, that reasonable people would consider hunting deer from a vehicle as something that can be done. Whether it's legal or illegal isn't determinative as to the outcome here. I believe that the gentleman may have had a handicap permit and allowed to do it in the Thompson case. Either Thompson or Phelps, that was the situation. But that's something that reasonable people would consider when using the term operating a vehicle as an activity that could happen in operating a vehicle. The question for this court to look at then is, do we take the leap of faith to say, well, reasonable people construing what would operating a vehicle would they consider, yeah, I guess it's reasonable to consider operating a vehicle as going down the street, pulling out a shotgun, and shooting somebody in the face.
Do you have any other distinctions between this and Thompson? Because I don't find the one that you gave me very persuasive.
Well, that to me is extremely persuasive that there's a difference between the two. I guess we have a difference of judgment with respect to
what
that.
What about the fact that in Thompson we were construing an insurance contract? Does that have...
Well, in fairness, that... Thank you. That was a point that I was coming to. Deer hunting cases that are really... that's the other real difference here, and it's a construction issue. The term operating a vehicle is to be strictly construed as it's in derogation of the common law. The term use of a vehicle, which is a little different term as well, that was construed in the deer hunting cases, was to be liberally construed in order to find coverage. So we are dealing with a completely different standard as far as construction.
What was the language in Thompson in that insurance contract?
I believe it was the standard arising out of the use of a vehicle language, which is, as you pointed out, a little different from the term operating a vehicle. I don't know necessarily that we can consider the two equal. I guess the one thing that I thought highly persuasive, you didn't find particularly persuasive, that is there's a big difference between shooting people and shooting deer in terms of a reasonable person's construction of the language.
But what's the language that you're construing? This statute says willful misconduct. I think shooting at a person is willful misconduct.
Well, I'm looking at the language operating a vehicle as to whether or not that constitutes when operating a vehicle. That's the issue here as I see it. That is whether or not the act of shooting somebody constitutes operating a vehicle. It says that...
It doesn't say operating. It says when operating. Was he operating? Was somebody operating?
Well, I guess the question is, what does the word when then modify, or what's the meaning of the word when? If you're going to give it a very broad and liberal construction, the concept would be when operating a vehicle means all you have to do is running the car. The other construction of that you can give is it means that the damage has to come from as you're operating a vehicle. This is a licensing statute, and that's that construction of when operating a vehicle as involving something to do with the operation of a car is what every case up until now has indicated is a necessary point. with respect to the statute. Even in the McAleon case, which Mr. Knurr cites, that was a drag racing case. That was willful misconduct. That was operating a vehicle. No case has extended that term when operating a vehicle to say that simply because you're driving a car, whatever happens at that time is therefore something that's covered with respect to this matter.
Would it make any difference? I was looking at the statute, it says while operating rather than when. I'm looking at 343.15.3. It says, insofar as negligence or willful misconduct on part of the minor while operating a motor vehicle. If we're going to interpret, is there any difference between while or when, in your opinion?
I'm looking at the provision you're discussing here. Any adult who signed an application?
It's in the last, second to the bottom line of three.
Just the bottom line of three.
Insofar as any negligence or willful misconduct on the part of the minor,
by reason of having signed such application or being a parent or guardian, insofar as any negligence or willful conduct on part of the minor while operating a motor vehicle. That's.
I don't see that I'm at a loss in it. Frankly, this is the first time I've noticed the question even to comment on, but at this point off the top of my head, I'm just at a loss to comment on what the difference would be.
It seems to be, if it's while operating, then it has to be subsequent to the cancellation for the while to apply.
I think that's clear as to what the rationale is, because there's when one place and while the other. If we can draw any conclusions from it for interpretation purposes, I really don't see how you could. I agree with you that subsection 3 refers to after the cancellations occurred. The bottom line with respect to this particular issue is looking at the purpose of the statute. I believe the purpose of the statute is to control and impose liability upon the sponsor to control, I should say, the minor's driving, to ensure there's a source there. I think more than anything, the purpose of the statute was to make sure there was someone there that would have a financial interest to secure insurance for the minor's driving. It is not a statute that opens the parent to unlimited criminal liability. I believe that the people of this state would be quite surprised to find that when they signed for that, walk in and sign for their child's driver's license, they had signed for any kind of criminal activity or any activity that caused anybody any wrong, as long as there was some sort of nexus somehow to a car, would be sufficient to impose unlimited liability upon a parent.
In fact, does this statute have any limit of liability?
It does not have a cap.
The limit imposes responsibility on parents for the actions of children. That is a limit.
That's right. It's an unlimited liability. There is no, for example, there's a cap of the medical profession enjoys now. There's a cap that municipalities enjoy. There are caps on wrongful death provisions that would apply in wrongful death actions. But this is an unlimited liability for a parent. And the construction that's being advocated by Leon Reyes would create an unlimited liability for parents for any type of conduct of the child, as long as there's some kind of connection somehow to a motor vehicle. This is a statute that's to be strictly construed, and I do not believe that the statute should extend in this fashion. This was as the Court of Appeals indicated in its decision, and we would ask that decision be affirmed. I don't want to dwell at length on the willful misconduct section of the statute. I believe, again, however, that's something that has to be strictly construed. The cases that have applied it, particularly the McAleon case, talked about drag racing as a type of thing that would constitute willful misconduct. Willful misconduct still, I believe, has to involve a car. It is not a term that involves any kind of criminal conduct whatsoever with respect to that. But the important thing is that this is a driving statute, and that's how it should be construed. Now, as far as the coverage issues go...
Which one is your strongest argument on coverage, separate from the sponsorship act?
I think they're all splendid, but...
Relatively.
If forced to pick, I think that there are... the use argument is a strong one to me. The intentional act exclusion is well supported by precedent, but personally, I think the public policy argument is a very strong one in this particular case. I think that any of those three they're all three important issues which I think this court needs to address. But the public policy one is the one that stands out in my mind. We have decisions that rape, sexual assault is not going to be covered by an insurance policy. We have a decision that a murder-suicide is not going to be covered by an insurance policy. We don't care about the niceties of the policies. This court has just said that conduct is not insurable. We have another case recently decided where it was indicated that even the grandmother is not entitled to insurance when the grandfather is charged with sexual assault and she's accused of negligently engaging in that type, negligently not detecting this type of a problem, and that's not going to be covered as well. In this case, the court's rulings, and Judge Simonic acknowledged this, as I quoted in my brief, he de facto gave Leon Reyes back $25,000 of coverage here. We're providing coverage for an attempted murder with respect to the way this record stands currently. And the public policy of this state should not allow that. This is a joint and several liability, and you're giving the benefit here to Leon Reyes. The cases indicate, and certainly the common sense would indicate, that this is not the type of thing that our court should put the stamp of approval on. As far as the intentional act exclusion, there's one thing I wanted to apologize for, because I believe I've used my natural talent to confuse things. At page 29 of my brief, I indicated to the court that there was a severability clause in the Great Way policy. That is incorrect. There is no severability clause, and I apologize for any confusion that I may have caused with that statement.
What page was that, sir?
Page 29. The sentence itself. I state the policy also contains a severability of interest clause, which generally provides the insurance applies separately to each insured person against whom a claim or suit is brought. That's an error. It does not contain a severability clause, and I apologize for the error. On the intentional act issue, Aaron was found ultimately at trial, although not on motion, to have committed an intentional act, and there was no coverage for him on that basis. There's been no appeal from that. The question the court must face on that issue is whether that finding would also preclude coverage for Cheryl. The exclusion indicates that there is no coverage for an insured person. If there's an intentional act by an insured person, the operative word being an, A-N. Cases from around the country have found that if the exclusion says an insured person, there is no coverage for anybody under the policy when we have an intentional act exclusion. The one case where there was a different result was the Nemitz case here in Wisconsin. In that case, we had a husband and wife who were involved in an arson, where the husband was the arsonist. The wife, I believe, was not involved in the situation. That case contained what's called a severability clause in the policy, which indicates that the insurance applies separately to each insured person. The court in that case found an ambiguity between the severability clause and the exclusion stating that an insured person in the intentional act language. And on the basis of that exclusion, on the basis of that ambiguity, found that there would be coverage for the wife or innocent spouse in the policy. In this case, we have no severability clause. Moreover, Cheryl Rothering is not a named insured person with respect to the policy. Therefore, it is our position that the cases from around the nation construing the phrase an insured person would apply here, and there would be no coverage under the intentional act exclusion for Cheryl because of Aaron's intentional act. The next, we also raised the residency issue, and I'll simply stand on what I indicated in my brief with respect to that, unless the court should have any questions on that. The final two issues I want to address are, one, first of all, the use issue. The question on that, I think, is summed up in three citations that I refer to in my brief. The policy language indicates there is the damages must be because of bodily injury resulting from the ownership, maintenance, or use of a car. I've taken out some of the language there to get to the heart of the matter. In the Tomlin case, the court stated for the use to be covered, it needs to be use reasonably contemplated by the, quote, arising out of the use, close quote, clause. In the Lauber case, the court stated, the question is whether the alleged use is one which is reasonably consistent with the inherent nature of the vehicle. And most importantly, in the Garcia case, the court stated, the inherent nature or use of a vehicle is measured by whether the activity is reasonably expected as a normal incident of the vehicle's use. And that, to me, really gets to the heart of this entire issue. Do we say in Wisconsin that it is reasonably expected that a normal incident of a vehicle's use is a drive-by shooting? I think it's a sad day if that's the conclusion that this court draws in this case, and that's the conclusion you're going to have to draw in order to find that we have use of a vehicle for coverage purposes under the Garcia language and under what would be a reasonable interpretation of that phrase. And that's where we really get into the heart of the issue that shooting deer is different from shooting people. Because if you ask people out on the, if you ask people and use your own common sense, some people would certainly say that shooting deer from a car, perhaps that is a reasonably expected normal incident of the vehicle's use. But I think you're going to have an awfully hard time finding anyone that says shooting human beings is something we want to say is a reasonably normal incident of a vehicle's use. Now, you can talk about the deer hunting cases. We can talk about the Tomlin case and the Snofer case, which came down on the other side of the issue. One was a stabbing where the court said that's not use of a vehicle, and the other was an angry homeowner took a shot at somebody, and that was not use of a vehicle either. We have cases in either direction, but the real question is a drive-by shooting going to be considered a normal use of a vehicle? That's something the average person would think. I don't see how you can answer that in a way that would find coverage as a use.
I'm pretty average, and you kind of scowl and said, would a normal person think drive-by shooting is a use of a vehicle? Well, I'm not sure I think that shooting a deer is a use of a vehicle either.
I'm not sure I do either.
That's your argument.
You could join the dissent.
I mean, that's your argument, that use of a vehicle for shooting a deer should be construed differently than use of a vehicle for shooting a human. I mean, that's your argument.
My personal belief is that you're right. I don't consider using a vehicle for deer hunting to be the specific language is reasonably expected as a normal incident of the vehicle's use. My personal opinion is I don't think it is. But under the facts of those cases, one, I believe, was a handicapped driver who had a permit to shoot deer from a car. I don't know if the other one was legal or not. My inclination is that one of the cases, it's Kemp and Feltz. The other case, there was not an opportunity, the person was not licensed to engage in that particular type of activity in that particular situation.
Just so you know, the wardens of the state of Wisconsin have traditionally taken stuffed deer and put them on the side of the roads in areas of hunting activity with the expectation that they would be shooting from a vehicle. And they have apprehended several people, some of whom I have heard about. So,
the record will still reflect.
Well, that being the case, I still think that if you talk to and this is my own, it's a judgment call, and you each have to make your own judgment calls. But my judgment call is that I can argue the pros and cons of whether shooting deer is considered reasonably expected as a normal incident of the vehicle's use. Courts in Wisconsin have indicated it is, and it is a use. But you tell me that somebody's got a gun, and they're driving down an inner city street in Racine, and they're pointing that shotgun out, and they're taking shots at people on the sidewalk. I don't think that's a normal, expected, reasonably expected incident of a vehicle's use, as the language is used in Garcia. I think that most people are kind of shocked at that as being a use of a vehicle, and they're not going to say, yeah, I think we should give insurance coverage for that. That's the kind of normal use of a vehicle that I'd like to see covered, that I think is a good thing to have covered, or that I think is right to be covered. And that's where I draw the line on that. And it's a judgment call, and you're going to have to make it when you come down to making a decision, assuming you get to the use issue. The final issue I want to address very briefly is the omnibus statute issue that Mr. Kinner just touched on in passing, and I also touched on that in my brief. 632.32.3 does contain language that coverage extends to any person legally responsible for the use of a motor vehicle. In the Mills case, the court held that that's to be construed in conjunction with 632.32.3a, which indicates coverage provided to the named insured applies in the same manner and under the same provisions to any person using a motor vehicle described in a policy when the use is for purposes and in the manner described in the policy. The Mills case and the rule concerning the omnibus statute has always been that that is a it is a non-discrimination statute. In other words, the insurance company is not allowed to carve out different sets of rules for a non-insured, for a non-named insured, as opposed to a named insured driver. That's all that it says. It doesn't preclude, it doesn't have the construction Mr. Knurr advocates. If it did, then Aaron Rothering is the person legally responsible here. I guess we could say that even he is entitled to insurance coverage under the omnibus statute. There'd be no need for any insurance defenses at all because the state would have given the rule that if you're legally responsible, you're responsible, and that's the end of it right there. The intentional act exclusion has been applied many times by this court in many different situations, and the omnibus statute has never been used to block its application. The use of a vehicle question, which 3A indicates is something that specifically we do have to consider when applying the omnibus statute, has also been litigated repeatedly without invoking the omnibus statute to block the use of that particular statute. The omnibus statute has never been used to block that particular argument that there is no coverage. The same thing would apply with respect to the public policy grounds. This court has found murder, suicide, and the sexual assault case, Hagen and Ramharder, I believe are the names of the cases cited in our brief. The court has found in those particular cases that there would be no coverage as a matter of public policy. The omnibus statute couldn't be used to evade those particular findings. The omnibus statute is simply not something that is so broad as to eliminate all coverage defenses, as Mr. Knurr argues on behalf of Mr. Reyes. In conclusion, this was not a car accident. This was not an intentional act with a car. It was a shooting. It's not covered by this driver's license sponsorship statute. If for any reason this court should feel that it is, you must reach the four separate coverage defenses we have asserted. Each provides a basis for which the Court of Appeals decision should be affirmed.
Counsel, I take it you don't have any legislative history.
Legislative history as far as the sponsorship statute?
Yeah.
We do not. Other than the fact that the various opinions that have been rendered over the years have seemed, at least to me, to go down the road of saying that this is a driving conduct is what's involved with it, and the legislature has not seen fit to step forward and amend or modify the statute to broaden it in any way, shape, or form.
The legislature could have looked upon this, part of Mr. Kuhler's position, that a vehicle can be used for a lot of mischief-making. And that parents are, if the parents are going to allow a child to operate a vehicle, they're going to be responsible for any mischief that's connected with the use of that vehicle, including a drive-by shooting. What's wrong with that? Why couldn't that be the intent of the legislature?
Well, number one, the statute was put into the driver's licensing section of the statutes in particular and deals with the way that a child gets a license and your responsibility thereafter. Number two, I've still back to my position that this is a statute to be strictly construed as in derogation of a common law, and that would be a very broad construction that you would be advocating with respect to that. Number three, looking at the statute, it talks about liability when operating a vehicle upon the highways. Now, it refers to willful misconduct. I believe the reasonable construction of that is that a child can't, that a parent can't get out of liability if the child says, well, gee, I was drag racing, as in the McCallion case, or I was engaging in some type of intentional conduct in operating a vehicle. But the language is when operating a vehicle. To reach so broadly as to say that the statute applies to a drive-by shooting, to a bank robbery. Suppose you go through a drive-by teller and tell them you want the money, you're going to blow up the bank. There are no end of examples that we can cite, and I cited some in my brief. You raised a good point when you said we're to construe the statute reasonably, we're not to construe it to an absurd consequence. And I think that's what we would end up with if we go so broadly as to say all you need to do is have some contact with a car and we have liability. And I think that's particularly supported by the cases over the years. We have seen language in the cases. I think the Halkey case, as far back as 1954, particularly talked about that was a theft of a vehicle. vehicle and then some damage. They made the comment in there that the problem here was the negligent driving of the vehicle causing damage, not the theft of the car. The court didn't look at the theft. The court looked right at the negligent driving in that particular case as the basis for sponsorship liability.
Your opposing counsel doesn't say, though, all you need is some contact with the vehicle. Your opposing counsel proposes a two-part test. The second part is that there be an integral relationship. Could you respond to that?
Well, what's an integral relationship?
Well, I suppose an integral relationship might be, this is not a shooting, this is a drive-by shooting. And a drive-by shooting may arguably be an integral relationship. You can't have drive-by shooting unless you have some kind of vehicle that's driving a car.
Well, you can't have, by the same token, I guess you can't shoplift something at the mall unless you have mom's car to get over there and shoplift. There's no stopping point for that.
Difference perhaps is the word when operating a motor vehicle. I'm not sure you're shoplifting when you're operating a motor vehicle.
To me, that seems a rather artificial standard that we're going to use this term when operating to say that if you have your foot on the gas, that's good enough for sponsorship liability, but if you take it off, there is no sponsorship liability. That strikes me as a very arbitrary line that you would be drawing if you did that.
Yeah, but that's the whole thing. Law draws arbitrary lines.
No question, that happens from time
to time. That's right. 18 is an arbitrary line, 21 is an arbitrary line, and this says you give your permission for someone under 18 to get a license, and when they're operating that vehicle, you are liable for negligence and willful misconduct. And that's it. And so if they shoot up the place without the car, parents are liable under another statute, or may not be. But when using that car, and the whole point about a drive-by shooting is to use the car to get away, to find a victim and to get away. And sure, it may be arbitrary, maybe going to the mall and using the car, but you've got a cut there, a break in the causation or a break in the relationship.
Okay, my red light's on, but
I know you can respond. Anyway, that's there's nothing, sure, it's arbitrary, but you've got to break some way. You've got to indicate that it's when operating, not arising from the operation of a motor vehicle.
I come back to the point that this is a statute in derogation of the common law that I've discussed earlier, and I also come back to the point that it is a driver's licensing statute, and that the reasonable construction of it is that it applies to if you hit somebody intentionally, if you're drag racing, if your kid is a terrible driver, you're responsible for it. It does not extend to the fact that you take a gun out and you shoot somebody, because that has nothing to do with driving a car. Thank you.
Could I ask one more question? Is this statute ambiguous? And if it is, why?
I think the statute, that's an interesting question. I think today I've heard an argument that the statute says all you need to do is to be operating a vehicle for it to apply. I think the statute is not ambiguous, but I think it's fairly clear that it means that the liability has to arise from when operating a vehicle. So Mr. Kinner and I take a different construction of it, and whether or not that rises to the level of creating an ambiguity is something you folks are going to have to wrestle with. I don't think it's particularly ambiguous. I think it's clearly just a licensing statute that meant to apply to driving conduct and had nothing to do with peripheral things such as the drive-by shooting or the harassing phone calls or anything like that. If you're going to use a rule of construction to find it ambiguous, though, the one that comes back to my mind is, it's not like a broken record here, but it's, again, the statute that's in derogation of the common law, and we'd be entitled to a strict construction of it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Nair,
you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
I would like to first focus on is the issue of the use in the Thompson case. American Family made the same argument that Mr. Simpson is making today. Quote, the injury lacked the requisite causal relationship to the vehicle's inherent use. The court stated, the act of shooting firearms out of a truck is not wholly independent of the truck's use transport the hunters closer to the deer they were chasing. In fact, the firing of the weapons from the moving truck was directly related to its use as a mode of transportation. With that quote in mind, now I go back to Aaron's cross-examination at trial. Question, let me see if I can make the question a little bit more simple. The use of your car was an integral part of pulling this off that night. Answer, of course. Given the scenario, I don't think if you're strictly looking at it from a use standpoint, you can say that just because it's a deer, that now we can distinguish this from what the court was saying in there, because everywhere that they use the term deer, you could substitute Aaron Rothering, because there's no question this vehicle arose out of the use of a motor vehicle. And just very quickly in closing, I don't have much to add here. If you look at what happened in this case, and you look at what Cheryl Rothering did, she conceded throughout that Aaron Rothering was a troubled child that she had no control over. Grades were slipping, truancy, petty misdemeanor acts, constantly in trouble. She used his driving privileges as an attempt, as a tool, to discipline him in the past. But then you know what she did? She gave up. She said, forget it. 6 weeks before this incident took place, she signed the car over to him. And what I'm saying is, under that scenario, when we look at public policy of holding a parent responsible for what their children did, would the public, when looking at the conduct of Cheryl Rothering, say, you know what, Cheryl, Mrs. Rothering, you're blameless. You know, you're blaming. No, she signed this car over to this child and said, that's it, as opposed to exercising her right and option to suspend his driver's license, to withdraw her sponsorship liability and say, you know what, I can't trust you behind the wheel of this car. I can't trust you, period. Start with that. I can't trust you. So by God, I'm not going to let you get behind the wheel of this 2,000-pound weapon and do what you please with it. So when you talk about public policy, I don't think it's such a stretch when you look at what this statute said. This statute, when you read it, is pretty darn broad. It says any negligent or willful misconduct when he's operating is going to be imputed to you, Mrs. Rothering, and that's a pretty darn broad statement by our legislature. And as somebody who has a son turning 16 in 9 months, I, of course, look at this statute with some trepidation, but I also say to you as a panel, look, I'm not advocating unlimited liability for a parent who sponsors a child. I'm not advocating that by any stretch of the imagination. I am saying you can draw a line. You can say, look, did the damage happen when he was operating? If answered yes, okay. Now let's go to the next step. Was this automobile integral to what happened that night when he caused it? If it is, then in that event, we're going to apply the statute as the legislature wrote it and find you responsible. So again, I'm not advocating unlimited liability, and I have no doubt that a decision can be fashioned here, that the lower courts, the trial courts, can say, okay, we've got a test here. We've got a certain set of facts here in front of us. Does it fit? Does it make sense with what the decision of this panel is with regard to the test? And I think that is something that the lower courts, particularly the trial courts, can do, because you...